Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckinistas? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. Happy you're here. Hope you're holding up. I should tell you that my guest today is the creator of the musical Hamilton. He wrote and performed in it. An amazing piece of work. Lin-Manuel Miranda is here today. Talk to him in a little bit. What's happening? I will be in Nashville at the James K. Polk Theater this Saturday, the 19th. You can go to WTFpod.com for tickets. I'm also going to be in Chicago. Chicago is on December 3rd. Two shows at the Vic, 7:30 and a 10, I believe. Again, WTFpod.com/tour. You get the information for tickets, links to tickets. Come on out. Let's hang out and talk. Let's hang out and talk. I did a very courageous and somewhat scary thing today. I did something I didn't think I would do. I didn't think I had it in me to do it. But maybe some of you can do it too. I don't know. Maybe it's not right for you. Maybe it's too much. But I'm pretty proud of myself. I'm proud to be American. And I'm also proud that that I took Twitter off my phone. Fucking gone. Hit the little X, watched it go away, and felt a relief. I felt a freedom from the bondage of self-induced post-traumatic stress disorder, of feeling the need to connect and react to a never-ending stream of garbage from the internet cesspool. I'm not saying that about my friends. You can all fight the good fight how you're going to fight it, but I needed to collect my thoughts. I needed to look around me. I needed to be in my car and not risking my life to react angrily to a tweet. I haven't really tweeted much in a couple of days because I don't. The energy is being misused. There's no way to let love in and figure out what the next right thing to do is if you're constantly consumed and jacking your goddamn endorphins and jacking your cortisol levels to skyrocketing survival heights just by engaging with eggs and hostile avatars of different sorts. The fronts of cowards and just people that want to annoy you. Fuck it. I got it off my phone and now I can walk in. It's weird. You get this, it's almost like a phantom limb thing where I reach for my phone. I'm like, got it. Oh, it's not there. Whew, a little bit of panic. Hey, wait a minute. Say hi to that guy. How's it going, man? I'm all right. What? That's a sample of dog food? I don't have dogs. I have cats. Clearly an odd reference, but it just happened down at the pet food store. So look, I'm trying to get on with my life and process my feelings, but it does hang over you like some sort of chronic diagnosis, you know? Well, you know, hey, that was a pretty good omelet. Oh, God, that's happening. I think I can go see a movie. That was a good movie. That was great. It was a sci-fi movie, kind of a fantasy that was sort of uplifting, alien save the world kind of thing. Yeah, I just went and saw Arrival. I enjoyed that. I'm going to think about it a little bit. Oh, my God. That's still happening. It still happened. So that, you know, that's going to be the way it is for those of us who feel that way. And yet there's two sides to everything. But look, you know, I went out and did some comedy. I started to really kind of parse, you know, what it means to be a comic, to stand up and be heard and be funny and not to be too strident, but try to figure it out from a human point of view. That's the problem with the right now with the vulnerability element, is that, you know, we have to maintain vulnerability and we have to move through the world with courage and a certain shamelessness of who we are and you know what we do and what we contribute to the world. Now things that were once comfortable are uncomfortable, and that could just mean going to the fucking store for some people. But we are all Americans, and you know, some of us got to push back, some of us got to fight, some of us got to resist. Do whatever you need to do to make your life mean something and to help other people. To help other people. And the cats. Got to help the cats, right? It was good to get out and do some comedy. See the other comedians at the store, how they're doing it, what's happening. Communing with the folks who come out, with the audiences. Speaking your truth. Can't stop that. It was good, man. It was good. When things get hairy and things get scary, I didn't plan on that rhyming. The intensity of life in front of you, you know, vibrates with an immediacy. You know, it's a time now. If you're feeling vulnerable, to lean on people that you love, get closer to people, go out in the world, say hi to people, make sure people are, you know, being nice, maybe saying hello to the clearly sad person. Help people that need help. Leonard Cohen passed away, 82. Great run. Left some amazing work, which is the best you can really hope to do in this life. And I spent the night that he passed away, spinning some of those albums. Songs from a Room, I think, is the one I listened to. And I was a late comer to Leonard Cohen. I tried, and I always knew he was great, and I knew it was good, but it was not connecting with me. And I guess it's maybe just for me, it was as I got older, I could deal with it. And I I'm a poetry guy. There's no doubt about that. I'm not necessarily a lyrics guy, but I'm definitely a poetry guy. And just some of it got so much deeper for me as I got older, and I guess as he got older. But I went back way back and listened to 12 songs. And I'm so grateful to have the work that guy did. A real Zen master, a real Buddha of the song. He will be missed, but we have his stuff. We have his stuff. That's the beautiful thing about music. You have the stuff. And this other very wonderful thing happened. And I don't really use the word wonderful that much because I don't love it. I don't love the word. But someone reached out to me, a fan of the show. And she just said that, you know, she had all these records that she wanted to give to me. And, you know, I don't know who she is, and she doesn't know if the Twitter account's really me, so I message her. I go, is this for real? Yeah, of course, I'd love to take some records off your hands. And she goes, yes, and, you know, we met at my office, and she brought over, like, 600 records, vinyl records, that I find out were her late father's collection. And it almost felt like this. You know, I could tell that it was a heavy thing. This is a loaded shipment that I'm getting, but she needed to let go of it. And I offered her money. She didn't want money. She just wanted them to be appreciated. And I had no idea what was in those boxes. She said he took very good care of them, and that, she couldn't move around. You know, every time she moved, she had to schlep these boxes, and it felt heavy to me. But then I felt like not only do I love records, and of course I want records, but I will appreciate them. I can be the custodian, you know, obviously not entirely emotionally, but of these records, and you know, and accept the responsibility. I know some of you are thinking, like, some responsibility getting a bunch of free records, but I thought it was a lovely gesture, and I didn't take it lightly. And there are some great records in there, things I never heard before, things that I avoided, some prog rock that I just never really paid attention to. There's some records in there that I think that maybe this gift is something I don't even understand yet, that somewhere in her father's collection might be a record that changes my fucking life. So I hope she knows that that could happen. That could happen. I'll let her know. Her name's Kristen, and it's lovely to meet her. And I feel the weight of the records, and I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to listen to new things, and I'm going to honor your late old man. So thank you for those. All right. So what's the point? Right? What's the point? Well, I think the point is you got to find the courage to be who you are. Look, there's a lot of people out there, left, right, people dealing with addiction, exclusion, you know, broken hearts, grief, angry hope, reluctant hope, complete defeat. But fuck it, man. You know, we got to be who we are, and you got to believe who you are as a good person. And you got to act on that now. And you got to be aware and vigilant of people that need some support. We got to get each other's backs. All people. Seriously. I'm a reluctant optimist, but I'm not going to surrender to PTSD of the onslaught of social media platforms or anything else. You know? Sometimes in this life, it requires courage just to go out in the morning. You know, sometimes for people, that's the courage has to have. Every day they got to deal with that. For years. That's just the way it is. But I'm wary, but I feel good. My guest today is Lin-Manuel Miranda, who created the musical Hamilton, which I saw in New York, and it was phenomenal, and it was a beautiful, there's nothing better than people collaborating to do something amazing and proactive. That I can tell you. And in the arts, that's certainly something that enriches life. Don't forget that if you're in the arts, because Hamilton was a real transcendent experience for a lot of reasons that I was able to talk to Lin about. And maybe if you don't listen to the show all the time, I told you about how when I was there, he knew where I was sitting. And as they were doing their curtain call, he looked over at me and he mouthed, "Boomer Lives." That was pretty nice moment. And it was like, it was amazing to sit here and talk to him. He's doing, he co-wrote the music and performed some of the songs for the new Disney movie, Moana. Lin and I do a little singing. I will tell you that. I'll tell you that right now. Yeah. Yeah. It's true. This is me talking to Lin-Manuel Miranda here in the garage. You want tans?
Sure.
Have you heard me ask that before, Lin-Manuel?
Oh, please pronounce it Manuel. Just call
Manuel?
Me
Lin. Lin-Manuel? Lin.
Yeah, that's much better.
Lin-Manuel, I can do. Yeah. I can do it.
You can also just do Lin, that's fine.
Is it?
Yeah.
I was told by people that you absolutely will walk out if I say Lin.
They're very sweet to protect me, but it's actually what I've been called all
Lin-Manuel.
Life. Yeah.
I can do it, man. I grew up in New Mexico. I can make the right sounds.
All right.
So how often do you come out here? This is a new world for you.
I've only ever been out here for work. I had a really surreal, my first show in the Heights played the Pantages.
Right.
And I lived, my first experience living in LA was living in the W on Hollywood and Vine.
The worst.
I mean it, the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, yeah, for real.
Oh, so you had to walk across that sad street with guys in costumes.
Guys in costumes. And also like, but also like homeless teens coming out of the train that no one takes. And next to like this hotel where Drake is upstairs.
Right.
So it's the dream and the dream deferred on the same corner.
Right. And how long were you here?
I was here for 5 weeks doing acting in that show.
That's right. That was the first musical you wrote and directed and produced.
I didn't direct. No, no. Tommy Cale, who directed Hamilton, directed
the same guy
too.
You've been with forever.
Yeah, yeah. He's my dude.
Like, I feel bad. I've not seen In the Heights.
That's all right.
No, it's not all right. I feel terrible because I know it was the first one.
It was. It was. I mean, and nothing will ever be that. Like, I went from broke substitute teacher to Broadway composer when that opened.
And you were a broke substitute teacher, but you weren't acting. You were doing things.
I was trying to act. The only role I'd gotten was I was a bellhop on the last season of The Sopranos.
I just watched it. Which episode?
It was they're going to get rid of something or check on a body. They're trying to find the Haven Air Hotel.
Oh, right. Right.
And
oh, right.
So... So I'm just like this tranked out bellhop who they ask where the Haven, and my lines were, I don't know, and ride off. And
I remember. I just watched it. You were out in front of the hotel and they were asking where the old hotel was, and you were just sort of like dead eyed and they were like, what the fuck?
And I'm so fucking green as an actor. You can actually see me look down for my mark.
Oh, yeah.
I look down to see where I'm supposed to stop.
That's a tricky thing, the marks.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially when they make them small because they're getting them on camera. So then you only have a dot. And you're like, how the fuck is that going to help me?
Yeah, and you know, it was an amazing first experience. One, because Gandolfini really was as kind and sweet as everyone. Like, stayed and did his scene, even though my side was second. Like, didn't have to be there for a bit player.
That's so sad.
But he stayed and did the other side of the scene with
me. He did.
And it was late at night in the middle of New Jersey. And then... the other actor, oh my God, his name is escaping
Paulie?
Me. Paulie.
Yeah.
While I'm getting
what
in makeup, he turns to me and he goes, hey kid, when you do the line, do it with like a real like fucking really thick accent, you know, so it's funny. So he's pitching me doing like a Latino accent and the makeup artist just waits for him to walk away and goes, he tries to direct everyone who comes.
Yeah. Paulie Galtieri was the character. Tony Sirico,
who's a very sweet guy, but kid, when you do it with like a real fucking accent.
He's really that guy.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was like, oh, that's that guy.
So I saw Hamilton and I was very, I almost started crying, not just because of the show, but you're walking off, you look right at me and say, Boomer Lives,
baby. So, I'm a big fan of the show.
You're so sweet.
Yeah, so, and it was, you know, you really look like yourself. So, and it's the logo of your podcast. So it's weird to see the logo of this podcast in the 10th row.
But you knew exactly where I was.
Yeah, well, I it was.
You seated me. It was like, you knew the seats.
But no, not that. It was like spotting Waldo. I was just like, oh shit. That's the cover of that podcast.
I'm Waldo. You found the glasses.
I did.
But let's, some of the things I found, and I don't want to have the same conversation you've probably had a million times about Hamilton, you know, outside of the success, but the one thing that knocked me out about it, and I kept thinking about, there were two things, because I talked to you quickly backstage with the other actor, I don't know everyone's name.
Right, with Chris, probably,
yeah,
Chris
sweet,
Jackson.
Yeah, and I thought, that was the original cast I saw, right? It was the last few weeks of the original cast.
Yeah, that's right.
But the thing that was great about it, outside of many things, was I knew the streets. It was New York. So it was like set in New York, and you're talking about these streets. I'm like, hey, I've been to Gansevoort Street.
Yeah.
And not only the fact that they've all been there that long, but that history that we forget is New York history.
Totally. You never think of the founders in New York.
Right. But New York was the place.
Yeah.
It was one of the colonies.
Yeah. And he's the New Yorker of the founders. I mean, that's the guy who never left Manhattan.
Was that one of the reasons why you found a portal in this story?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It was... I knew what most people know when I picked up that book, really at
Which
random.
Must be not much. He's on the $10 bill.
I knew he was a 10. I knew he was like not a president, but on our money. And I knew that he got shot. And I also knew that his son died in a duel because I wrote a paper on that in 11th grade. Like,
you did?
Yeah. You know, I think I wrote about that because, you know, I was like emo goth teenager. I was like, oh man, his son died and then he died the same way.
It was before he died? His son died?
Yeah, his son died in a duel 3 years before he did. And it was like pretty much the same spot in Weehawken, like in the same area. And I just thought that was really
Weehawken.
Fucked up.
It's fucking, that's New Jersey, isn't
it? New Jersey. Yeah, it's across the river.
It's like, and we're just talking about The Sopranos. It's so weird, the time travel necessary that, you know, and I think that places it historically, especially for people who live in New York or who have spent time in New York, because our ideas of what these places are so detached from history.
Right.
So the story sort of roots itself. It's time traveling, but it's also the geography is the same, and it humanizes it just from the geography.
Totally. Yeah. 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 So to walk around and say, I can't believe when we're in New York, which is what the Schuyler sisters do, is how everyone feels when they get here. And so you telescope time and suddenly you relate to these characters.
Right.
It's not this other century in this other period of dress. It's like, oh, I'm in New York. Oh, I'm downtown. Oh, I'm like watching the energy here.
And the Meatpacking District is nice now. Yeah. And that's where a lot of it was, I think. A lot of those streets were down there.
Yeah, Meatpacking District is uptown. I mean, they were all down in the Battery too. Yeah.
Well, and also the thing about that is that somehow or another, and this is part of the brilliance of the conception of it, is that, you know, you can have a multi-ethnic cast playing founding fathers and people of that time, which are not historically accurate, but it doesn't matter because it's New York.
Right. It's true. New York. That's exactly true. Yeah, it's New York. And everyone lives here.
Right.
And that's one of the things that we love about it.
And outside of the money, you know, if you're not talking about, Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, where people are looking at it going, that doesn't look like him. No one gives a shit.
Right.
And that this is a human story.
That's right. It actually, yeah.
It's an immigrant story.
It takes them off the money.
Right.
It takes them off the money to cast it that way. And honestly, that came out of the sound of what I was writing. It was like, well, this is a hip hop R&B show. We need people who can pull that shit off.
Right.
And that was really sort of, and then Tommy, in his direction of it, elevated that to a principle. All right, well, then this is going to look like our country.
Right. So, so you get obsessed. So you write this story in 11th grade, but, you know, whatever triggered the Hamilton thing, that book by, what's his name? Ron
Chernow.
Chernow. I didn't read it. It's a big book, and I don't seem to have the attention span to read a lot of books. But when you picked that up, I mean, what was the motivating force? So we said, you know he's on the money. You had a vague idea of who he was. You knew he's from New York. But then you see this book. The book was everywhere. Was it one of those things where it's like, I'm going to read that book?
I was just in the biography section at Borders. Like, I was just looking for a big book to read on vacation.
When there were big bookstores.
Yeah, when there were big bookstores. Right. It was the one in the Time Warner Center.
So you're walking
around. It's Forever 21 now, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was walking around and I knew I was going on vacation and it
where
had
were
good-
Where were you going?
I went to Mexico. It was like, I had a week off from In the Heights. It was my first vacation from that show.
How long did that run?
That ran just shy of 3 years.
And that was also a story about immigrants in New York.
Totally.
But you've been a New York kid the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, I was born in Roosevelt Hospital. Grew up.
Where's Roosevelt Hospital?
That's actually not far from that Borders. It's on like 59th and 10th. My son was born there 2 years ago. Same hospital. It's just west of Columbus Circle.
And your parents grew up, what part of the city were you in?
My parents met at NYU grad school. They were both born in Puerto Rico. My mom grew up here. My dad came here for NYU. He sort of always—
From
Puerto Rico, got a full ride. He's like the prodigy, like graduated college in Puerto Rico at 18.
Uh-huh.
He's the Doogie of Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh.
And then he came here to get his education. He was always gonna go back and he met my mom and stayed. And so when I was born, my parents and my sister and I lived in the NYU grad housing. We lived in Silver Towers downtown
where
in the village.
Where was that? What streets?
That's like on 3rd Street. That's like right near McDougal and all.
Not far sort of, from Hamilton?
Yeah. Yeah. That's totally. Yeah. And then we moved uptown to Inwood, just north of Washington Heights in like 1981.
It's pretty up there. It's like by Grant's Tomb. Around there?
No, Grant's Tomb's way downtown. No, it's like
way
top, like north of the Cloisters.
Right.
We're
north
of the Cloisters.
Right.
And because I think those neighborhoods were in such rough shape, I had the rare sort of New York existence, grew up across from a park. You know, grew up in a house with a driveway in Manhattan.
Right, because that's where the houses are.
Yeah.
Not
brownstones, like a house.
Right.
And it was, you know, my dad tells the story. We bought the place and there was an uptown Irish tenant. And my mom's the one who interviewed and got the house. My mom's last name is Towns, which is a pretty ethnically indifferent last
name.
How
is that?
That's a whole other story. But my mom's half Mexican, half Puerto Rican. Towns is the Mexican side. If you go back far enough, it's actually someone actually wrote an article. I found out about this on the internet because someone did my genealogy
really?
Sort of for free.
And you had no idea.
I had some idea. I'd heard some stories, but someone really went and laid it out. You know, Towns is a result of this guy. His family owned slaves. He married He married his mother's slave and ran away.
Where was this?
This is in way the fuck out west. And they basically, this couple, this interracial couple, basically kept moving. The Towns family, David Towns and his wife, they kept moving. And then they would change the law and it would be illegal for them to live together and they'd move further south until they got to Mexico and then sort of grew up in Mexico. And that's why Towns is a Mexican last name for our branch of the family.
No kidding. So he started in the south.
Yeah, he started in the South.
And then kept moving because of his love. It's a passion story.
Yeah, it's a passion story. They had kids and they just kind of kept moving.
And they knew that, and he didn't want to hide his love anymore, I guess. So he'd rather honor the love and keep moving to finally find a place where he could live and have his family.
Right. And then for
is this the next musical? Are we talking about
I don't know. That's a hell of a story to read about yourself, though, online.
It's a hell of a story in general because it seems to speak directly towards themes that you enjoy.
Absolutely. And it's also, you know, you think, my parents are both from Puerto Rico, but no, there's no one in this country that isn't tied to our fucking complicated racial history and the legacy of slavery. There's no one it doesn't touch.
Right.
You know, I never thought about it in those terms as a kid. I was like, well, both my parents are Puerto Rico. They grew up on an island and generations. But no, it touches everyone.
I think that's true. It's weird because I'm thinking about my own family and that I go back maybe 2-3 generations back to, you know, first generation immigrants from Europe.
Right.
So like my American history is a little shorter.
Yeah.
But that American history is much longer.
Yeah.
You know, all right. So you find this out when? After you wrote Hamilton?
Yeah, this was like
recently.
This was like 9 months into the run.
So what does that propel you to think about? Do you think about like who are the other? Do you have family that is you're curious about that you might
absolutely.
Know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Towns is a pretty, you know, if you meet most Townses, if they're not members of the Mexican side of the family, they're African American, and so that split happened at some point. And at some point, some of those people in our family said, oh, well, we can pass.
Right.
You know, we can pass and we're Mexican and we're light skinned enough to pass on this side of the line. And so there's this amnesia whenever that split happened. But it did. It had to have.
Well, that reminds me of the Jews that were expelled from Spain during the Inquisition, ended up in Mexico and sort of moved up in Mexico to New Mexico. They found like Sabbath candles in some Catholic churches that have been going on for hundreds of years, and they didn't know why.
Yeah.
But it was a leftover tradition from the original Jews that were expelled that were now, you know, Mexicans.
Isn't that incredible?
It is kind of incredible.
Yeah,
that there are these family histories. So tell me more about like when you wrote the inspiration for The Heights. Clearly comes from, you know, the neighborhood you grew up in. So how many sisters and brothers do you have?
I got one older sister.
That's it.
Yeah, she's 6 years older, and you know, we grew up. I grew up in a little Latin American country. I mean, if you go north of 181st Street, especially in the 80s, I mean, it was all, you know, it's classically Washington Heights and Inwood have always been an immigrant community. First, Irish, and then tons of Jews after World War II and during World War II, and then huge wave of Latinos, Cubans, and Puerto Ricans, and then Dominicans in the 70s. So it was really a Dominican neighborhood when I was growing up in the 80s.
Was there still like
Irish Brigade Pub,
right.
Irish Eyes,
right.
Liffey 2, they're still there.
Like, was there any Jewish like butcher, you know, shops?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeshiva University is still there.
Right.
I mean, Yeshiva is sort of the cornerstone of that community. I got an honorary doctorate from them. But that's also an important part of our community. And so it's always been, and I saw that starting to change. And Kiara, my co-writer, and I sort of, we both live in that neighborhood now. And I remember when I was in college, the first Starbucks showing up. And, you know, it's that thing you deal with of, you know, immigrants live where they can. They make the place special. And then, you know, and then there's a point where it gets so unaffordable that the people who make the place special can't afford to live there anymore.
The artisanal colonization begins.
Correct.
And first the yuppies and now like hipsters who refuse to call themselves yuppies because they don't dress like that.
Yeah, right.
The coffee shops are different.
Yeah, the coffee shops are different.
Yeah.
And also, but yeah, it was I was seeing that shift happen, and that's hard to dramatize. You know, it's hard to, you know, there's a lot of musicals where there's an outside force change.
Gentrification is hard to dramatize.
Yeah, yeah, in a way that feels compelling and feels high stakes. You know, you look at Fiddler on the Roof, like, oh shit, like, you know what the outside threat is in that world. It's intolerance, and it's a wave of hatred that's coming, and it's even going to break the bubble of Anetevka and this place where things have been done the same for hundreds of years.
When did you first start engaging with musical theater that where it took on this life for you, where you could, you know, draw parallels to your life? I mean, where did you start thinking, like, when did you first see Fiddler on the Roof?
I saw Fiddler on the Roof in first grade. My parents were obsessed with musicals.
Really?
They're of the generation that just had cast albums next to, you know, my dad had Man of La Mancha next to Dionne Warwick, next to Gran Combo and Celia Cruz. And that's just the cocktail of music we grew up with.
And also
house.
That's the benefit of living in New York, is that not only when you're dealing with the sort of... the character of the neighborhood that is all ethnicities.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, everybody's up in your face. There's no way to avoid right. contact and engagement. And there's an acceptance to that because you learn how to sort of say hello to everybody and appreciate everybody.
Yeah. And I'm also grown up uptown as hip hop is being born.
Like, and down the street, you can see any fucking musical you want and you can go see any symphony you want. It's sort of a fascinating place that all that stuff is available to you. But your dad was, what did he do?
My dad, he came to New York to study psychology, and then didn't have the patience for it.
You mean literally or temperamentally?
Temperamentally. Like, he would do the practice sessions. I shudder at the thought of being my dad's patient because my dad said he'd hear the person complaining. He'd go, "You said that last week. Process it. Let's move on to the next thing. I only have 10 free sessions with you." Whereas my mom stayed a psychologist. She's a great psychologist.
She's still a psychologist?
She's still a clinical psychologist.
And, in Manhattan?
In Manhattan, yeah. She does a lot of custody cases.
Uh-huh.
A lot of child psychology where she'll be sort of the one, you know, she'll interview and a family and sort of help make a recommendation where the kid should go. Really like heroic work she does. And my dad's in politics. My dad got really involved in school boards and community organizing uptown.
Yeah.
Because my sister was going through school there and he was just sort of fighting for her. And then he kind of fell into politics. It's exactly his skill set. He got hired as the mayor Koch's advisor for Hispanic affairs in his last term. And he went from railing against the enemy to being like, oh, I'm the Hispanic spokesperson for Mayor Koch. And
who is the enemy?
Well, you know, the enemy is underfunded schools, and
right.
the enemy is redistricting, and
right.
the enemy is, you know, getting the same resources everyone else gets.
Right.
And then he, you know, he actually really flourished under Koch. Koch uh-huh. was a guy, a really complicated legacy, but my dad learned a lot about how politics really happens there.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm the kid who's dragged along to meetings. You know, I remember sitting in Koch's office in the back, like coloring.
Yeah.
While like they're fighting about whatever they're fighting about in the corner.
And Koch was nice to you?
Yeah, Koch was really nice to me. I spoke at my dad's swearing-in ceremony, and that was my first time in front of a microphone. I'm 7 years old, and me and my sister like sort of did little speeches about our dad, and I'm in like in a little gray suit.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, Koch was always wonderful to us, and we'd go to Christmas parties at like Gracie Mansion, and it was really crazy. And I was like a little kid running around,
yeah.
while like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are like, you know, I'm running between their legs.
They're just hanging out. They're around.
Yeah. And then he went from there to a lot of different nonprofit jobs. And then when I went to college, he quit the nonprofit sector because he couldn't afford to be a nonprofit anymore.
Yeah.
And he started a private political consulting firm. And that's how he paid for my school, my education.
And he still has it?
Yeah, he still has it. And it's interesting. Like,
who are most of his clients? How does that work?
He does a lot of New York political clients. He ran Freddie Ferrer's mayoral campaigns. He just got Adriano Espaillat is the first Dominican elected to the House of Representatives. He just got him elected. That was one of the bright spots on election day.
Yeah, what happened?
But he also will represent, you know, he's fighting against Herbalife because Herbalife is that giant fucking Ponzi scheme.
It's
that like
Amway thing, yeah.
Yeah, that really takes out Latino communities.
Like, really?
It's really sort of entrenched in Puerto Rico. And it's
in terms of being an entrepreneurial option for people to get out.
Yes, that doesn't really get anyone out.
No, you just get the kit.
You get
your friends and your family to buy three things.
Yeah. So,
and then it just sits in the closet.
Right. So he fights against stuff like that. He was hired to help, get the Yes Network in the Bronx because it was insane that like this cable company wasn't providing the actual Yankees games when the Yankees play in the fucking Bronx. So it's shit like that. Like that's the kind of stuff he
That's
does.
What's interesting about New York politics because of the density of the population. There's always a hands-on sort of like fight to be had every morning and that, you know, it's all very practical, you know. It's not abstract.
No it's,
you know,
not abstract.
Shit needs to happen right here, right now. It's not sort of like over there. It's here. So you're growing up with, you know, a clinical psychologist, two people trained in clinical psychology, and you're already engaged in the politics of race to a degree.
New York politics is not removable from race.
And also there's the idea of you know, how do you make it in America, that's hanging over everything.
Absolutely.
And that's what that was sort of the story of In the Heights, right?
Yeah. And it's also but the other thing with In the Heights, the really sort of, I think, biggest reason that I started writing that show, because I started writing that show when I was 19 years old, was that I wanted to have a life in musical theater. I was a kid who figured out who he was in the school play. That was my corner of identification in the hierarchy of high school, because you get friends from different grades. So when shit gets real in your grade and someone hates someone or you're the bad guy that day, you can go hang out with someone in a different hallway.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Like who's going to graduate and you're going to be sad. But like you have friends outside of the bubble of the life or death stakes that are happening.
Emotional stakes. Yeah. In that of bullshit sort of status jockeying and bullies and you know.
Yeah, theater existed outside of that. Like,
oh, no, theater. Yeah, it's safe haven.
Yeah, it's total safe haven. And even kids who were the bullies would occasionally audition. Like, no one doesn't want to be in the school play.
Right. The guy who's a one-note guy, maybe his one note will be the right one. They go, I'm a football player. You'd be perfect for the guy that's got one line. Then maybe they'll surprise you and sing well.
There's a famous alum of my high school named, his rapper name is Immortal Technique.
Uh-huh.
He's one of the most sort of politically ideological. He really made sort of an incredible life for himself as a rapper.
Right.
He was our school bully. And he terrorized kids. He'd throw them in the garbage. I got thrown in the garbage by him.
Isn't that interesting?
And he was a really angry kid. And it's been wonderful to watch him grow up and like find a political outlet for that anger.
Right.
And
to know who the enemy
is. But he was just Felipe and he scared the shit out of us.
Right.
But he was in the school play. Like he got a part the senior year. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in a fucking play with the dude who scares the shit out of all my friends.
And were you surprised at that moment by his, like, because it's like usually when someone is, you know, strutting like that or a bully like that, that, you know, when they're in a different situation, you can sort of see their vulnerability and
he's got to memorize his lines.
Right. That's a vulnerable place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. So you see Fiddler when you're in first grade, but then do you keep going to musical theater?
That's the thing. I mean, I think I'm like a lot of kids in that I fell in love with cast albums. Like I've never seen Man of La Mancha. I've never seen Camelot, but my parents played them so much. I've got this idealized version of them in my head. Like
just the arc of the song.
The arc of the songs and the way those told a story. And I sort of found I always found that I gravitate towards music that tells stories. Leonard Cohen yesterday, like Suzanne, I think, you know, I think of those
gut puncher.
Leonard Cohen has my favorite quote about songwriting, which is, being a songwriter is like being a nun. You're married to a mystery.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know if I wonder if the world could handle a musical not unlike Mamma Mia or some of the other ones they've attempted
Leonard
to do.
Cohen's
with
Leonard Cohen's
be a heavy evening.
It would be a heavy evening. Like, all right, here comes the ninth verse of, he's a tower. But anyway.
It took me a long time for me to appreciate him, because I didn't quite, register it, because I'm not, a lyrics guy, and I've talked about this before. I'm a melody guy, and I'm a fucking rock guy.
Yeah.
So for me to listen, when I watch Hamilton,
you're working hard.
Well, yeah, because I don't have the reflex of hip hop. People who listen to hip hop, it's not an effort to understand what's happening, or follow it. But for me, just to pay attention to something other than beat and melody, it's sort of like, oh, I gotta work, I felt like an old person at that show. I'm sure there's a lot of people my mother's age going like, it was hard to follow because you gotta listen and you gotta follow the rhythms, and they're not ingrained in me. I like hip hop, but it was not what I was brought up with.
Right. No, I feel that way when I go see Shakespeare. Even if it's a play I've seen, I've seen Macbeth maybe 50 times, and you go and it starts and you go, oh shit, I forgot how to listen to Shakespeare. I'm in a panic the first 10 minutes, and then your brain clicks into it. Like, there is a rhythm to the speech and the pentameter that you go, okay, no, I'm with it.
Yeah.
It took me a second to orient myself, and I'm with it. And I think the same thing happens with Hamilton.
No, definitely.
You go like this and you clench up like, oh, are they going to be talking this fast all night? And then you get,
But
Leonard
also,
Cohen, then she gets you on your wavelength.
That's right. And then you walk into the wavelength, but also you're dealing with, the interaction. There are people interacting, and talking, in this rhythm. So, that engagement where it's not just coming at you, forces you to feel the emotion of it. And then that locks you in also on a deeper level.
Yeah.
That everybody sort of, and the songs are pretty.
Yes. So I love musicals, but, if you're a Puerto Rican dude, here are your options: Bernardo in West Side Story, Paul, the Puerto Rican dancer in Chorus Line, who gets one big monologue, and that's about it. And I didn't dance, and so I was just like, I don't see how I can have a life in this.
But also, what was the reaction on the street?
What do you mean? Oh, in my neighborhood?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that was, it's funny. I got into my school when I was five. So
Which school?
I went to Hunter, which is like this magnet school on the Upper East Side.
Right.
You have to take 3 IQ tests to get in. And I got in kindergarten.
Right.
So I had the conversation, are you Lin-Manuel, when I was 5 years old? You know what I mean? I go from speaking Spanish at home to speaking English at school. And that, in a way, I'm really grateful for it, because I sort of learned how to talk to very different types of people at a super young age. A lot of kids, when they grow up in my neighborhood and then suddenly they're in college and they go, holy shit, there's no one like me. Like, what the fuck am I doing here?
Yeah.
I had that happen when I was 6 years old.
So so you were in college at that age? I don't understand. So,
the school's called Hunter College Elementary School.
Oh,
At a CUNY.
I got it.
And so it's sort of it's a public school, but it's a gifted school.
Right.
Quote unquote gifted school.
And that was something that your parents were like, we're going to try to get him in here.
Yeah, I had a really rough time in nursery school. They're like, we got to get him, we can't afford private school.
Right.
Like, he's got to be smart enough to get into this motherfucker.
All right, so you were able to cross that cultural boundary at a very young age, and it became adept. You became sort of, it was second nature to you to deal with the two worlds. But
I had my friends in the neighborhood who went to school locally, and then I had my friends who lived on the Upper East Side.
Did you ever get shit for being a musical guy in the neighborhood?
I got shit from being a musical guy everywhere. That's part of it. I had the advantage of my great uncle in Puerto Rico was an actor. He was a really famous actor on the island, actually. His name is Ernesto Concepcion. So my Latino side of the family, who they're normally the ones who give you shit, like, what, acting? They got it because we had a family member who was actually made a living at it. So it wasn't quite as stigmatized as it might be in other families. Yeah, and made a living in Puerto Rico, and his son is still a really talented actor on the island too.
How much time did you spend in Puerto Rico?
Every summer. So, and that was the other thing I got. So I'm switching between the Upper East Side and 200th Street. And then every summer I get sent to this tiny town, Vega Alta, Puerto Rico, population, I think it's like 70,000 now.
Uh-huh.
Where my Spanish is so shitty that like kids my age just, I start to engage and they go like, you talk weird. We're going over here. So all my friends in Puerto Rico were my grandparents' friends. I'm still close with all the little old ladies who survive, who are over there.
Yeah.
And I was hanging out with them and watching He-Man in Spanish and watching fucking Flintstones in Spanish, which is called Las Picapiedras, which means the stone cutters. So
you feel very connected to it.
Yeah, I feel very connected to it because and I'm grateful for that too, because a lot of kids whose parents come from somewhere else really feel a disconnect from their ancestral place of origin. And I don't. Like, I had summers there. I ate the food. I worked. I had a part-time job, like, in Puerto Rico. And so that was, that's also a part of...
Is your home bilingual now?
Yeah. Yeah. My wife grew up in Washington Heights, too. And she's an even crazier mix. She's Dominican-Austrian. Hmm. Her dad grew up in the city. Like, her dad was, like... I think of him as like a character in The Bronx Tale. Like, he grew up when it was like black block, Puerto Rican block, like, and it was turf. He had a doo-wop group. Like, it's like that level of that New York in the, in Washington Heights. And then her mom's Austrian, like, came here as a teenager. She grew up speaking Spanish. She got sent to DR every summer. She was sent to the Dominican Republic. So she also had the weird, like, I have this connection to my island, but I go to Hunter and I live on 184th Street.
Right.
And so so when we met, we went to the same high school, didn't know each other in high school.
Huh.
We were 2 years apart. she's very much more logical than me. I always say, yeah, she was 2 years younger than me. And she goes, I'm still 2 years younger than you. Stop saying it in the past tense.
It's going to be that way for all
of
it.
Exactly.
It's going to stick that way.
Yeah, but then we re-met in our mid-20s, and it was one of those like, oh, we had the same experience and didn't know each other while we were living through it.
And you have one kid or two?
We have one kid. He turned two, yeah.
You speak Spanish at home?
Yeah, he speaks Spanish and English and a smattering of Austrian German thanks to his oma, to his grandma.
That's wild, dude. All right, so you go to the Hunter school.
Yeah.
And you, as you said earlier, at this time, hip-hop was infusing the neighborhood and also the culture of people your age.
Yeah.
And that was really how you thought and enjoyed popular music. Outside, you had this musical, this weird ingrained in you, this musical passion.
Yeah, and I always just loved music that told stories, and so genre becomes fluid.
Yeah,
you know, it's
right.
You know, and you know, this sounds crazy, but a huge help in that was fucking Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Like, I was a little kid, and when you listen to Weird Al Yankovic, you realize that genre is just the clothes the artist puts on and
right.
the orchestration. Like, he'll do a polka version of fucking Hot Rocks.
Right.
And you're like, oh, it's the same chord progressions, the same melody. It's just played on an accordion, and suddenly it's a polka.
Interesting. So through his parody, were able to sort of deconstruct the structure of any sort of song.
Yeah, and you realize that, like, oh, my hip-hop friends are alienating my musical friends, but, like, we just like music that tells stories. One of the first rap songs I memorized, I had a great bus driver. We had to take a separate bus that took us into school because I lived so far from school. And our bus driver, I think, wanted to be a rapper, it never happened. His name was Billy Baker Jr. And he would rap to us all the way to school.
Uh-huh.
He would do KRS-One raps, and he made us memorize Rapper's Delight. And one of the ones he did that he made us memorize, this is in my 40-minute ride to and from school, was called Beef by Boogie Down Productions, aka KRS-One. And it was all about being a vegetarian. And I never heard the actual song until I was an adult. I only heard my bus driver's rendition, but it was beef. What a relief. When will this poisonous product cease? This is another public service announcement. You can believe it or you can doubt it. Let us begin now with the cow. The way it gets to your plate and how. The cow doesn't grow fast enough for man, so he has drugs to make a quicker plan. He has drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker. 21 different drugs are pumped into the cow in one big lump. Just before it dies, it cries in the slaughterhouse. Like, and then he starts going on about Elijah Muhammad. And like, it's like, we learned this like radical, like, don't eat pork, don't eat meat song.
From your bus driver.
On our way to third grade.
You love that guy.
Love that guy. So grateful for that guy.
What happened to that guy?
He's still around. Baker's Transportation. It still drives around my neighborhood. It's still taking kids to school. I still live up there.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That like, you know, one guy like that. Not even a teacher.
Not a teacher.
The guy driving the bus, they're sometimes the coolest people. You got to see him every day. He's got limited time with you, but he can put on his own show.
He puts on his own show. And we learned mind playing tricks. I mean, I really got a hip hop education.
Did he get the whole bus singing?
Yeah, he'd get us all singing. I mean, can you imagine?
Thank God for that guy.
Thank God for that guy. So hip hop and storytelling is coming in on the bus. I'm listening to musicals at home. I'm getting cast in the school play. And then—
Did you do any stuff at school?
Yeah, yeah.
What'd you do?
I did this is the musical theater version of Who Are Your Guys?
Yeah.
Who
Are Your Guys?
8th grade, I played the Pirate King in Pirates of Penzance. Oh, no, sorry, that's 9th grade. And that's a big deal. To get a big role when you're a freshman, that's like everything, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'd arrived. And then 10th grade, I was Judas and Godspell. 11th grade, I was the assistant director for Chorus Line. My girlfriend was the director.
Yeah.
And then senior year, I directed West Side Story.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you, now, at that time, so this is high school.
Yeah.
And this is a gifted school.
So yeah, I'm one of 5 Puerto Ricans in the school.
Right. But also, are you learning, like, I imagine you're learning, you know, the necessity of lights, of choreography.
Yeah. The other blessing was it was a student run show.
Right.
It wasn't like a faculty directed show.
So you had to sort of get into that, the collaborative nature of theater.
Yeah. And you learn, I mean, I think the life skills you learn on that you take with you the rest of your life, because you can't hire or fire anyone. You have no sway over your fellow students other than get them excited about making something, you know. There's no grade for this. It's extracurricular. There's no tangible benefit. So you just have to learn how to inspire other people and work with other people. And you know, that was immeasurably like...
And you're a kid.
And you're like, we're going to have a secret rehearsal on spring break,
because we have to.
Even though it's not, you know, one of our mandated rehearsals. And you learn how to just... And then there's the kid who's like, no, I'm going on vacation. You go, well... And you can't fire them.
Right.
You can't say, fuck you. You go,
well, we'll make do without you.
Yeah,
but
we'll figure it out.
Right.
And so you really learn a lot of how to get people inspired and get people going without anything other than the idea itself.
But let me ask you, I mean, like, you know, a collaboration is a collaboration. You may acknowledge, you know, differences and uniquenesses and different in backgrounds and stuff. But did you ever feel the weight of it? Of being one of 5 Puerto Ricans in that school?
Yeah, you feel the weight of it. I mean, that's the, and I didn't even realize I felt, because I got there at such a young age.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it until I went to college and made friends with other Latino kids who had that experience.
Yeah.
You know, I lived in a house, a Latino program house, my sophomore year at Wesleyan. It was called La Casa.
Uh-huh.
You had to write an essay to get in. And suddenly my friends like also are first generation. And I didn't realize how much of myself I was leaving at home.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to high school,
uh-huh.
You know, I loved being in theater, and my friends from high school, I'm still in touch with them. I'm still close with, but then I got to school and I was like, oh, like I can share jokes with these guys that I never would have brought to school.
Right.
You know, it's like an entirely different level. And that's when I started writing in the Heights. It was when I realized, oh, my experience in Puerto Rico, my experience in my neighborhood, that's fair game for me to write about.
Right.
And you know, when you bring all of yourself into a room, not just the part that is useful for the person you're talking to,
mm-hmm.
which is something I learned to do very well in school, unconsciously.
Right.
You know, unconsciously you go, no, just call me Lynn because I can't
right,
deal
right.
with manual.
Manual.
You know,
what I did. Yeah. Just to call back the beginning of the show. Mark Maron said Lin-Manuel.
But you learned
Manuel.
But we, you know, I learned at a very young age how to just make people comfortable. And I learned to adapt at such a young age that I didn't realize the power of bringing all of myself into a room much later.
But that's interesting, though, because adapting is the beginning of collaborating on some level.
Absolutely.
In terms of your creative growth.
Yeah.
That, you know, you knew who you were, you weren't ashamed of it, but you innately adapted to the cultural
context. Yeah, I talked about the things that we can talk about.
Right.
What was on TV last night.
And then at some point you realize, like, I can celebrate the things that are different.
Yeah, and I can bring you something you maybe don't know about.
There you go.
You know, that's what In the Heights was the beginning of. It was, I'm going to take the Latin music I grew up with, and I'm going to play with that in these songs. Because I was writing musicals already in high school.
And there's no fuck you to that, there's celebration to that.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah, and there's no way to interpret it as fuck you.
Yeah.
Unless you're sick.
Yeah, unless you're sick. unless you literally see something different as a threat.
Right. But so now, what other stuff, when did you start? You started, you know, conceiving the In the Heights in high school. But
in college. In college.
Yeah. But in high school, did you do any original work?
Yeah, I wrote one act musicals in high school.
Uh-huh.
I wrote one my junior year. Actually, did I tell you this? I think I told you this when we first met after the show.
Backstage, it was all very adrenaline.
The guy who directed my first musical was a 15-minute musical called Nightmare in D Major.
Yeah.
Chris Hayes.
Yeah, Chris Hayes.
Chris Hayes.
Political commentator.
Grew up
Chris
in the
Chris
Bronx.
Hayes.
We took the bus home together.
Yeah.
And we were really good friends. He was a year older than me.
I know. I had him in here. He has a fantasy of returning to theater, you know.
Well, he played Zach in A Chorus Line, and he was fucking great. And he was a really great dramatic actor.
He's a sweet guy.
And directed my first musical. My grandmother used to call Chris El Mexicano because he was the only one of my friends who, when he would come over, would speak Spanish to my grandmother. Because he would always work in summer jobs, and he spoke Spanish pretty fluently for a white dude. And so she would always say, ¿Dónde está el Mexicano? Where's the Mexican? And the Mexican was Chris Hayes.
That's so, it's cute, and it's moving, you know, because there was that working class, civic minded.
Yes.
Family that you both came from.
Yeah, that's right.
That you weren't, there wasn't this sort of, you know, gunning for the prize, which I think, you know, we all do innately, but we'd like it to be true to ourselves. I think that's somewhat of what that first musical is about, right?
Well, In the Heights, sure.
Yeah.
Nightmare in D Major, on the other hand, was like about a fetal pig from AP Bio coming back for revenge.
That's the one he directed?
That's the one he directed.
And that was a musical?
That was a musical.
So was that a Little Shop of Horrors kind of?
Yeah, it was like all this weird dream, right?
Okay.
So it was, you know, there was a lost love, and then there was this fetal pig. It was so fucking bad. It was like, I'm just a fetal pig. I'm not very big. So why did you cut me up in bio class? And she comes back with a knife and threatens him. And then she dredges up all the monsters from his subconscious to fight him. Like, here's your alcoholic Uncle Steve. Like, here's your fifth grade nurse. You know, it was like a really crazy
Sounds deep,
fucking
though.
Show. Yeah, it was. I mean, for me, for 16, it was pretty deep. And then my senior year, I wrote a musical called 7 Minutes in Heaven, because write what you know. So I wrote a musical about the first unchaperoned party I went to in seventh grade, where half the kids are like ready to make out and like do all the shit.
Yeah.
And half the kids are like, I thought we were watching Disney Afternoon, right, and like still kids. So
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah,
you're on that weird nexus.
Right.
And that's like one of the first songs I wrote that I'm really proud of. There was this little girl who sings, you know, in sixth grade everything was very clear. You guys go play, we're fine right over here. But suddenly we're interested in what they have to say. They're just as stupid as they were last year. Like, she's the girl who's like, why are we fucking with boys right now? Like, we were all fine on our side of the line, and now all my friends are obsessed with making out with those idiots that we were just playing with.
Yeah.
Which is kind of how I felt, like lurching into middle school. Like, whoa, wait, are we doing this? Are we like racing to second base and third base? And who's gotten to second base already?
Right, right.
Is that a thing? Am I behind the curve?
And
on
what exactly
shit?
Do you do at third base?
Yeah, I never understood third base. I didn't understand third base till I was past it. To quote Chorus Line.
Is that a Chorus Line line?
It was. I didn't know what a puberty was until I was almost past it. Yeah, that's a chorus. That's a chorus
I like line the more line. Specific version.
Yeah, but
it's easier to put this in there than it is to figure out how to work it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I get Frenching. I get. Getting under the shirt. I don't know what happens after that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. In between third.
There's fluids involved.
Yeah. In between second and home plate. That's
a world of mystery.
Well, you got to ask questions. And, you know.
at that age, you're not going to be asking questions.
That's right.
And they're not going to volunteer the information to you quite yet.
That's right.
They will eventually.
Oh, man.
Did you ever consider doing straight hip hop? I mean, not in terms of musical, but like pursuing a career as a rapper or hip hop artist. I mean, you ended up being a hip hop artist, but
yeah. But I think if I had been around that more in my day to day school life, I think that's probably the direction I would have gone in. We had one really great hip hop group in our school, and I sort of worshipped those guys. They had a band called Dugis. They're still around. And
they were a group. They were like a roots type band.
Were a band, and they had MCs, and they were great. And all I ever wanted to do was, I was in Pirates of Penzance with the main MC from, his name is Lauren Hammonds. He's a great guy. Mm-hmm. And I would sheepishly be like, I wrote this rap, do you think it's any good? Like, because he was already a senior, and he's such a gifted MC.
Yeah.
So then I never got any encouragement in that direction.
Yeah.
So I just sort of, you know, it just sort of bled into the musicals I was writing.
So when you go to college, you went to Wesleyan.
Yeah, in Connecticut.
So that's a big shift.
But for a New Yorker too. I passed my driver's test the day before I went to school. Because, you know, when you grow up in New York, like, who the fuck needs to drive?
It's a lot of people. It's very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Anyone who grew up in a city with good public transportation, you're like, I don't fucking need to do that.
Yeah, and then you're in your 20s. But I had the luxury of, my sister had a hand-me-down car that she wasn't using because she lived in the city.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, you can have a beat-up Saturn, like, if you pass the test. So I passed the test the day before. I basically learned to drive at school.
And when you packed up your car, that was your first big trip.
My first time on the fucking highway.
Was it?
Yeah. On 95, fucking hands at 10 and 2, shaking.
It's actually easier.
Yeah.
I mean, in turn, you can relax a little bit.
Yeah, a little
bit. I used to love driving in the city. When I had my car there, when I was running up and down the FDR at, you know, 1 a.m. to do comedy spots, it was exciting.
Yeah.
To drive in the city to catch that run of lights, where you're like, I'm going all the way downtown on this run of green lights.
My version of that is catching the 2-3 at 96th Street and getting like 72nd, 40th. It's the closest thing we have to time travel.
Right.
I was like, oh, I thought it was going to take a half an hour. Fuck, there's a 2 train. Yes.
Yeah, boom. Yep. Beautiful. Yeah, I took the subway to Carnegie Hall the other day. It was great. How many times did you take the subway to the theater to do Hamilton?
Oh, I mean,
all the time.
It was a bitch at the Public.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, I live, it's the A, and then there's no real good way to go east. You know, in New York math, it's harder to go east than it is to go north-south.
Right. So you get to college and you were now in the arts program?
I wanted to be a double major in theater and film.
Mm-hmm.
And then, just like in high school, theater ended up taking up all my time. So yeah. I did my core requirements for film and then never pursued it. And just started, I was writing and acting in shows in equal measure. And there's no musical theater major at Wesleyan. It's very avant-garde. It's very viewpoints. It's very...
Like what was being taught?
Oh, well, you get taught the canon, right? You get your Tennessee Williams and you get your, you know, Three Penny Opera and Brecht and you get all that good foundational stuff. But the stuff people are putting up is very
esoteric.
It's esoteric. Yeah. I was in a play by Maria Irene Fornes called Molly's Dream. It was the first play I got at Wesleyan, and it's like a super out there play where I'm a guy who's dressed as a cowboy and 5 women are all like hanging on to me. And I have no idea why. I did not understand the symbolism of the play I was in. And so I'm also trying to make like musical theater happen, which is very odd at Wesleyan.
And no one was putting up musicals.
They were, but all extracurricular. It wasn't a thing that the actual theater department focused on, and
sort of
was,
like in high school that you know, you had, or like, or where I went to college, you had a stage troupe that would either do a play or they'd do a musical, but you didn't see many musicals from the theater school.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. And so I kind of supplemented that because I knew what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I would go, you know, I'd take voice lessons and I took piano lessons
outside of school, or in school?
No, within the music department.
Okay.
And then found a great professor who saw In the Heights when I put it up at Wesleyan and did a tutorial with me. So I got like a semester of credit just doing a private musical theater tutorial.
He took a liking to you and mentored you. He said, this kid's got something.
Yes.
And, you know, this is not something we see here, but it's valid.
Absolutely.
And who was that guy?
Bill Francisco, who is a legend at Wesleyan, was one of the legendary, super eccentric, super brilliant theater directors. And we, my class got him, and he retired our year. Uh-huh. So we sort of got the last of his brilliance and strangeness. And in dealing with him, I learned to navigate every mood because he had a lot of them. And some days it was, you're brilliant and this is wonderful. And one day I remember being in a rehearsal and there was a love scene in the show I was writing. And he said, are we all sitting here because Lynn can't get laid? Like, is that what the fuck we're sitting here paid to watch? I can't deal with this, and walk out. And like, it was, I never knew which bill I was going to get from day to day. On many levels.
So again, the adapting kid is put to the test.
Put to the test by a brilliant, but also very moody genius.
So when you score, you know, because I have musical in me. I stuff it down.
You push it down.
I push it down. But like a lot of times I find myself like there, it's very, in, you know, sort of like nicotine lozenges.
Yeah, you make up the song.
I'm here with my thermos again. You get
beautiful. Beautiful. But that instinct is just the instinct that you nurture when you write musicals. It's the, when do we break into song?
Right, but there's like, but you can, like, I don't go to many musicals, but I know, like, the, like, you know, if I go, there's my thermos, I put,
but
coffee.
Why are you singing like that? Like that's the thing.
No, I know, but because I'm not, I didn't take it to the next level. That's your job. What I'm saying is I know just after that, that I can go, like, there's my thermos with coffee. And how will I drink it? When am I going to drink it? Thermos, you know, I, you know, like I could feel it.
Oh, you went to Finiculi Funicula. I can. thermos, dun 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 dun. Finiculi Funicula.
That works.
Yeah, it works. But it's so funny when you think musical, suddenly it's I gotta sing like this. And
but there's a little of that in there. I don't care if it's hip hop or not.
of course there is.
You gotta do that.
Yeah, but for me, my favorite musicals are where you have that and you have that layer of artifice that we're breaking into song, but then it also feels real. It also, you have those moments that feel conversational. And those are also my favorite moments in hip hop.
I think that's the tricky thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, to have a story that isn't rendered ridiculous.
Correct.
By the nature of the mode.
Yeah. And the best songwriters can do that. They can make heightened speech feel like something we'd say in our real lives.
Uh-huh.
Whether it's Sondheim with a little priest from Sweeney Todd, with them singing, you know, how about priest? Try Little Priest, you know, and it just feels like they're talking, but it's this incredibly elaborate rhyme scheme.
And also, like, you just by what you just did there, you know, I realized that, you know, with the benefit of song, you can really talk about heavy shit.
Absolutely.
And deliver it in a way that it's like lubricated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you, all of a sudden, you don't realize until it hits your heart, you know, what's happened.
Totally. You sneak it in. You absolutely sneak in whatever you like. You know, one of the biggest showstoppers in Hamilton is this song called The Room Where It Happens, where it's from the perspective of a guy who is not at a meeting, but then the shit he's saying, I mean, and you're seeing dancing and you're seeing this incredible stagecraft and incredible orchestrations by Alex Lacamoire, but, you know, the lyrics are the art of the compromise, hold your nose and close your eyes. You know, we want our leaders to save the day, but we don't get a say in what they trade away. We dream of a brand new start, but we dream in the dark for the most part.
Wow, it's so irrelevant. It's like, you know, you're writing from a historical context, but politics has not changed.
Not a bit. Not a fucking bit.
It's fucking fascinating. Yeah. So now, okay, so you do this personal story about your neighborhood, you know, that is, you know, it's your first musical and it gets a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And now when you do orchestrations, do you write music?
Yeah, I write. So the way I work is I play piano. I'm a pretty shitty pianist, but I can play just well enough to write my songs.
And you can read music.
And I can read music. And that becomes part of the process, too. Like if a melody can survive my chops,
yeah,
then it's catchy enough to survive. You know what I mean?
Like a jingle.
It's got to survive like my fruitlessly getting it wrong until I've got what's in my head down on paper.
Uh-huh.
And what I, my way of working, I think the fastest way to work is I'll make a big you know, Heights was written in GarageBand and Hamilton was written in Logic.
We're writing it. We're in GarageBand now.
Yeah.
Me and you.
Yeah.
We exist in GarageBand.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
All of In the Heights got written in GarageBand. And then I send these files with rudimentary arrangements. I've played the bass part. I've played the guitar part. I've played the piano. And I, you know, send it to Alex Lacamoire, who then orchestrates it. He assigns, you know, he adds all these colors in the way he assigns the music to different parts. And
what's his job title?
He's the music director, and he's co-orchestrator. He's the orchestrator and arranger.
Okay.
For my work.
And you're the guy you've worked with forever, Thomas.
Tommy Kail, yeah.
You worked with him in college?
No, we met the week after I graduated college, but he directed In the Heights. We went to the same school. But,
and who co-wrote In the Heights with you?
Kiara Hudi. She came along in 2004 when I realized I can't do all three of these jobs. And, you know, I was writing the whole thing then, and I didn't want to let go of music or lyrics, but I was happy to let go of sort of libretto duty.
Yeah.
And she was, it was like heaven.
What exactly
sent.
Is the libretto? That's the story?
That's the story. That's the dialogue. That's the structure. You know, it's sort of the unsung art form in musicals.
Right.
The running joke is, you know, if a musical succeeds, you don't notice the book writer at all. If a musical fails, it's the book writer's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Kiara wrote an amazing libretto for us. And she grew up in North Philly, so she understood sort of that immigrant neighborhood changing in the same visceral way that I did. And first in her family to go to college. And sort of she really like got those characters. And, you know, she was working from an existing show that I wrote in college. And then we sort of ripped it up and wrote it from scratch when she came on board.
Wow.
Yeah. She's incredible.
And that did well for you?
Did well. Like, to me, that was the pinnacle of how well a musical could do. Like, we won Best Musical. We ran 3 years. We had a touring company.
And you're acting for the first time?
And I was acting. I was, you know, I got out of the bellhop outfit and got to play a leading role in a musical. And I wrote my own sort of opportunity in that way.
Yeah. I know that. I know that feeling.
Yes.
But you had not been hitting the boards too long with auditions and stuff. I mean, you were always working on the musical, right?
I was always working on the musical. I was substitute teaching to pay my rent.
But you weren't like going out on auditions every other day, were you?
No, not really. But I did. I mean, yeah. I went on voiceover auditions.
Sure.
I went and, you know, I didn't have an agent for a really long time.
Right.
So
yeah. You got one now, though, right?
I got one now. Yeah. But Heights was my calling card in a pretty big way.
And that solidified you.
Yeah.
Your talent and also your world that, like, you know, not unlike your father's entrance into politics, they were like, all right, we've got a Latino guy that speaks the language of art and love and music and everything else, and he can do it for a mainstream audience.
Yeah, and I think what people recognize in that show, both traditional musical theater fans and people who want something new out of their musicals, was these guys love musicals. You know, there's a lot of people who sort of try to write shows for Broadway, and we go, we hate musicals. That's why we wrote one.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they get met with difference by the community, and In the Heights is such a love letter to the music, to Fiddler, to fucking, I mean, everything I grew up loving, in the same way Hamilton is. You know, I didn't want to burn it down and start from scratch. I wanted to write my version of a musical.
Right, but there was also some precedent. I mean, there was, you know, like, I remember when I was a kid, you know, going to see the black cast of Guys and Dolls.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Bringing the Funk, Bringing the Noise, and
yeah,
some of the stuff.
Yeah,
that
came out the same year as Rent, and that was a watershed year. I mean, that was 1996.
And Kushner's musical I saw.
Yeah, Carolina Change.
Which I thought was tremendous.
Incredible musical.
And what else? Like, because I just talked to George Wolfe, and when I was there to see Hamilton.
George Wolfe is amazing.
He's great. And I went to see Shuffle Along, and there are such
an incredible show.
It was a great show.
Yeah.
And there are similar themes.
Absolutely. Who gets to tell your story? Yeah. And maybe one of the greatest companies we'll ever see.
Like,
in Shuffle Along.
It was astounding.
It's crazy. It's not still running.
It is a little crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, but see, like, that's an interesting question, because, you know, Hamilton is now going to run until, you know, your kid can play the lead. So... most likely it's never going to go away. They're going to rename the theater. It's like the Lion King did, you know what I mean? Like, this is going to be the Hamilton Theater. That's fine, congratulations. But the interesting thing about Shuffle Along, it's a specifically black experience.
Yes.
And
it's about a story that isn't told, and is
Black history, yeah. And it's Black history that was sort of passed over by the Black community and also by the show business community, obviously by the white community, and he resurrected something that was a missing chunk of the history of show business and the history of the Black experience in America. Why isn't that show running?
I'm genuinely sort of asking myself the question. I think what happened with Shuffle Along is in a lot of ways what happened in the Heights. There are things that we just have cultural baggage about.
Yeah.
We can't help but have it. Some people will hear hip hop and that is a barrier to entry for them. They think that's not for me. I'm not going to, and Broadway's fucking expensive.
Right.
So they think that's not for me. I'm not going. You know, In the Heights won all the things it could win, and yet by the standards of the stuff, the success it had, didn't run very long because hip-hop, Latin musical, that's a lot of cultural barriers for the people who can afford Broadway tickets.
Right.
And I think a similar thing happened with Shuffle Along. It was this African-American history, and you know, there's no barrier to entry there. You know, some of the greatest musicals, you think of The Wiz, you think of Porgy and Bess, you think of, there's such an incredible history of African-American musicals written by African-Americans, starring African-Americans. For whatever reason, something was a barrier to entry for people. And I don't know what that was.
Yeah. But I think
that was true of In the Heights too, of people being like, yeah, not for me. They heard the elevator pitch and they're like, not for me.
Yeah. But I think also that, you know, working people, you know, do get priced out.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
That's
it's so fucking expensive to mount the show.
And how do you sort of like, because I know you guys did take action to sort of make the production more available, didn't you?
I mean, the biggest priority we had was kids have to be able to see the show. It's useless to put on Hamilton and not have the kids who are studying this shit not have access to it. So we developed a program where 20,000 school kids are seeing Hamilton every year, and that's going to continue with the touring productions. Like in every city the show will go to, we will partner with the Title I schools and get the kids who are studying that into the theater. You know, we can't solve the problem of supply and demand. You know, the magic of theater is that you're in the room with the thing, and I don't know how to solve 1,300 people, you know, that's how much we have room for.
Right, but also the soundtrack is available at a reasonable price.
And the soundtrack is the whole show.
Yeah.
And it's a sung through show.
Yeah.
So you get the entire plot and everything.
And then you're giving kids that experience that you had.
Yeah, it's exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's how you experience musical theater.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah, because we didn't see many shows. We just, I just fell in love with cast albums.
When does this, like, and we're going to get back to you buying that book in a second, but when does this, like, when does it, is it available for, can high schools do it?
Not yet.
Right.
There's sort of, the life of a show is, if you're lucky enough to get to Broadway, and it does a little well, you do a tour and more people can see that production. That's the same footprint and the same, everyone's involved. Like Tommy and I are putting up those tours. We're casting those tours. Mm-hmm. Some shows get the luxury of a UK, production. We're getting that with Hamilton. We didn't get that on In the Heights. There was no one interested in mounting that in the Heights. There's a production there that's doing well now, but it's not our production.
Because that's been freed.
To
the royalty
after
system.
After those run their lifespan, you go to Stock and Amateur. And that is...
That's where you buy the books at. Who puts out those books?
That's right. It's either MTI or R&H or Tams Whitmark or French's.
French's.
So those are the big four in Stock and Amateur land.
Sure.
And that's when school productions happen and regional productions happen. And you have some level of
but that's just part of the arc of the life of a show.
That's the arc of a life of a show.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's like the way TV shows go from first run to rerun to syndication.
Sure.
We go Broadway to tour to stuff.
Now, are there plans to make a movie?
Of Hamilton?
Yeah.
Not for a while. I'm in no rush. You know, I really feel like... We work so hard to make a thing that works in the theater.
Sure.
I want people to see it in that form first. I don't want the movie, which will be an act of translation, if it's brilliant or if it's terrible.
Well, you did study it a little bit.
I did study it a little bit.
It's your next evolution.
Yeah, I'd like a you know, there's the musicals that go straight to movie. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your Hairspray, or you have I don't know. I'm trying to think of other shows, and then you have the musicals that like take 30 years, like Chicago. open the movie of Chicago, which I think is actually better than the show even. Mm-hmm. I thought Rob Marshall did such an amazing job with that thing. Came out like 25 years after that show debuted. So
what was interesting to me too is that, like, in that, you know, 5 minute conversation when we met, yeah, backstage with who's the guy with the shaved head,
Chris Jackson, who plays George Washington,
right, who was great.
Yeah,
everyone was great. I was honored to see the original cast, you know, like, very quickly, you know, I'm scrambling to connect with you to adapt to the world of the backstage at the musical of the big musical star. But, you know, we locked in on this the model, which, you know, I said, you know, I was nervous to say it, but I said it was like Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head, by the way.
Yeah.
Because when I was reading that book, I thought, oh, this will be my Jesus Christ Superstar. That's really what I thought when I started reading Hamilton's story, was I could write songs, you know, my skill set of writing hip hop and R&B tunes fits this dude's life perfectly. Because this is a guy who needs words and needs, and sort of never shuts up. The kind of music I write will service his life really well. And I'm going to make a concept album, which was what Jesus Christ Superstar did. It was a concept album first, and then they figured out how to stage it later.
Really?
Yeah. It was not conceived as a show.
That was a record my parents had, and that was a record that I listened to as a kid.
Yeah.
And when I saw the movie, I was like, what the fuck?
But they all get in a bus and out to the desert.
Right. Norman Jewison and all these hippies, they go out in a bus and then it unfolds. Yeah. Right.
I always think of the Mr. Show spoof of it too, which was so
I don't remember that.
Oh, it's brilliant.
But I don't know if I saw it. But the thing that, like, you know, really kind of locked it in for me was, you know, two components. Was that, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar was narrated by Judas, who was dead. And, you know, and Aaron Burr, who was definitely the villain in a way of your show, he's the one that comes out and starts the story.
Yeah.
The one that killed the guy.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And so, that's directly inspired by Jesus Christ.
And then, like, you know, is it King George? Like Herod's song.
He's totally our Herod.
which is my favorite song. So if you are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ. Prove to me that you're no fool.
Walk across my swimming pool.
Just do that for me. Like, I remember that. And then
that was well sung, Mark.
Thank you. So then when George comes out and does his bit, I'm like, this is it. This is it.
Yeah, he's Herod.
Right?
Yeah, totally. Totally. And that was the fun of that. And then you, as you're writing it, you realize, so that's your inspiration. And then you go, okay, but this isn't actually Jesus Judas, because it's not follower who turns into enemy. And you, but I look to the musical theater sort of predecessors. So is this Amadeus? Is this Mozart Salieri? Kind of. There's times when Burr is envious, but this is not a case of someone having genius and someone having not. They're both brilliant.
Yeah.
So it's actually, as I was writing, I realized this is a difference of temperament. This is a guy who is cautious versus a guy who is reckless.
Right.
And
cautious in a surviving within this new structure. Like, he was cautious as a careerist.
He was a career cautious.
Yeah.
And this guy who, in a lot of ways, is very similar to him, Hamilton. They're both orphaned at a very young age.
But Hamilton's like, but a sort of a bipolar genius in a way.
Yeah.
Maybe not bipolar. I don't want to throw that word around, but
he definitely had mania. I don't know about the other side of it,
right.
but definitely had moments of mania.
So when you start thinking about these elements, had you finished a book, or is this happening? You buy this book in Borders. You're looking for a book to read in Mexico. And I'm assuming, projecting, and I can just ask you that, you know, you picked this book up and you couldn't put it down.
Couldn't put it down. Became my vacation. Was like, you know, this is 2008. So, you know, my wife, then girlfriend, and I were at like an all-inclusive resort. We're drinking margaritas. I'm reading the book. We're watching season one of Mad Men on DVD.
Yeah.
And that was the vacation, was just reading that book and being like, oh my God, the song the British sang was "The World Turned Upside Down." How fucking great. It's just me circling shit that I think, you know, makes sense
as you're
in musical form
it.
As I'm reading it. The first time through.
You know, what was it like right when you're reading the book where you're like, this is my guy and this is my protagonist?
He wrote his way out of the Caribbean, when he literally wrote, there's a hurricane that destroys St. Croix. He's living in St. Croix. He's a teenager, but he's running this trading company. He's doing the books for this trading company. And this hurricane destroys the island, and he writes an essay about it. And the essay is so flowery and beautifully written that it gets published in the Danish American Gazette in an effort to get relief efforts for the island. And people take up a collection to send him to the colonies to get his education. They say, go become a doctor, come back. Because you're too smart to be here. And to me, I was like, well, that's the most hip hop shit I've heard. He literally writes his way out of his circumstances.
Right.
And I had that notion, and then the book sort of kept proving me right. The fact that he wrote under a pseudonym when he was writing against the British Crown, like, oh, MCs, like writing under pseudonyms, like just like every piece of hip hop culture that I respond to had some reflection within his life in some way or another.
And at that time, when did the conceptualization to make it, you know, about New York in a way? And then also to honor the idea that these characters, although historical characters, are fluid ethnically.
Yeah, well, I mean, that came with that initial inspiration. So the first time I'm reading the book, I'm not picturing the literal founders anymore. I'm picturing, okay, Hamilton's a mix of Big Pun, Biggie, Pac, and Eminem. That's who he is in the conception of how he's going to rap and how he's going to sing. You get to George Washington and you go, okay, this guy is all moral authority. Okay, so he's Common. He's John Legend. He's those guys who just project this innate goodness and majesty. So I'm dreaming, you know, I read the name Hercules Mulligan. I go, well, that's Busta Rhymes. Uh-huh. That's the most fucking awesome series of syllables. Hercules Mulligan. Like, I heard it in Busta Rhymes' voice when I read it on the page. So I was already casting hip hop stars as the founders the first time I'm reading the book.
Uh-huh. And your guy who, what's his name? David?
Diggs. Yeah.
That he was it was interesting that I don't know how long the casting process happened, yeah, but it was like, it's a very profound thing, you know, especially, you know, in a time now where you know, aggressive politics is going to be part of our cultural reaction and language, is that, you know, you're taking a story about one of the founders and, you know, not only integrating it but elevating it through, you know, ethnic fluidity, which is a word I don't know if I made it up, but you understand what I'm saying.
I do.
That represents a story that is about all of us.
Yeah.
And you know, when you were casting that, what were you looking for exactly? I know you're honoring these voices in your head, but you know, you got to have, you know, real song and dance guys.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've got to have the ability to sing and dance and rap, and they don't teach you how to rap in musical theater conservatories.
But was it a thing for you when you were casting, saying like, none of these guys are going to be white?
No, it was. We never put down that dictum. It was. We got to find the best people to do this, and we got to represent. We have to represent the most sort of beautiful diversity of people we can find.
Yeah.
And that's
New York City.
It's got the sort of the calling card was, this has got to look like the A train.
Yeah.
It's got to look like one car on the A train. And with all that represents mariachi bands, break dancers, whatever the fuck.
Right. And then you get this amazing story about a guy who's a flawed guy.
They're all flawed. Oh, they're all so flawed. But yeah, but our main guy is deeply flawed because he's the only one to shut the fuck up.
Uh-huh.
And
he doesn't keep his dick in his pants.
And he doesn't keep his dick in his pants. And he, and the thing that is his strength is his undoing. You know, he writes his way off the island. He writes his way into Washington's good graces. And then when he's presented with the fact that he fucked up and some people know about it, he decides to tell the world, oh, yeah, I fucked this married lady, but I was always honest in my business affairs. And he thinks that's going to like save him. It was totally used against him. And you can also see that as an act of patriotism. You know, if if there's stench around him as being a corrupt public figure, as a guy who misuses treasury funds or misuses government funds in any way, you know, the country's 5 fucking years old. That could be the end of it. So he instead blows up his personal spot. You know, I was friends with Mike Nichols before he passed.
You were?
And I got cast in a reading that he did shortly after in the Heights, sort of a reading of a play that nothing ever really happened with it. But we went to dinner, and this was before I'd written any of Hamilton. I said, I think I'm writing something about Hamilton. And he said, that's the last honest American. He was a big Hamilton buff, and he always pointed to that moment of that guy ruined his life to save the Republic. And his wife, like, taking the ultimate affront of blowing up his personal life and his infidelity and stuck by him. Like, he thinks those are the two of the most courageous Americans who ever lived. And he was at our last workshop before we opened it to the public. That was the last time I saw him.
How often did you counsel with him through the process of creating it?
Not so much on this, just sort of checking in, and I would tell him, you know, I'm done. And we invited him to that last workshop, and I was so thrilled to have him there. Tommy Kail, there's a great quote where if Tommy Kail had to make his Mount Rushmore of directors, he would say Mike Nichols and Hal Prince twice. You know, those are the guys. Yeah. And so, you know, I think the fact that he always respected the historical Hamilton, he was very happy that the show was going to have a kind of a life. And he was a wonderful guy. The last email I have from him was just after my son was born, just saying like, oh, it's all different now.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to find all new stuff.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, with Hamilton, you know, you were able to deal with class. Mm-hmm. You were able to deal with not only just an immigrant story, but also a story about politics, about love, about, you know, desire to transcend your class. Yeah. And all the stuff that, you know, that are conflicts and parts of the American experience now, obviously.
Absolutely.
Now.
They're coming for me. I've said too much.
I thought that was just your ride. I thought you were at that level now.
No, not yet.
They're going to chopper you out. No.
Gotta go. The ladder drops into the garage.
But now, like, you know, dealing with, you know, as we were talking when you came in, that you said you were en route from London on election night, and you landed in this.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about your political consciousness. You know, you're a young man. And
bless you for saying so.
Oh, come on.
I'm 36.
Yes. Yes, you're a young man.
Thank you. That's very sweet.
And, you know, you know, your creative life evolved in, you know, a fairly, you know, restrictive political environment, you know, being the Bush years and everything else. Yeah. And that, and your political life, I guess, started then as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I got to my hotel after flying on election day, and I jumped immediately into a big Skype session with the same group of friends that I have spent the last four elections with. It's my Wesleyan.
So two Bush and one Obama.
Two Bush and one Obama.
Two Obamas.
Got very stoned in 2000, waiting for a president to emerge.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wesleyan's a pretty left-leaning place. I fell asleep, but my friends all went to False Hill and wailed and howled at the moon, and just sort of wailed like, how is this happening? 2004, we were at my friend's house in the Village, and no matter how many times we played Eminem's anti-Bush song, it didn't break our way. And just remembering getting very sort of sourly drunk. And then 2008, we were in the same apartment and danced in the streets and danced in Union Square.
Do you remember, like, were you in New York City when 9/11 happened?
Yeah, I was on my way there because it was primary day. That was a voting day.
Yeah.
And my dad was running Freddie's mayoral campaign. So I was going to drive down, vote, and come back. And it was also the day Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind album came out.
Yeah.
So the first thing I did in the morning was, I knew I was driving to the city. I went to the record store in Middletown, Connecticut, Colony Records, to buy the new Bob Dylan. And the very stoned, sleepy guy who runs that shop was like, hey man, someone like tried to blow up the World Trade Center. And I said to him, yeah, that happened like 8 years ago. Because I was thinking about the first time.
Right.
I was
the guy in the van. Yeah.
And I was like, this guy's really out of it.
Yeah.
And he said, no, man, it's a... And then got like very like clear-eyed and said, it's a really good day to buy a Bob Dylan record.
Mm.
And I popped it in my car. And then when I drove back home, I turned on the TV and the second plane was flying into the tower. And I remember just sort of people coming over to our house and serving drinks and calling family members. And because I was supposed to drive. And then we heard that Manhattan was sealed and I wasn't able to go down because there was no one getting in or out.
But you were able to get home?
I got home a few days later.
Wow.
And my dad was downtown. He saw it. He was running a campaign. And, you know, in his mind, he says, Freddie Ferrer would be mayor if that hadn't happened because they suspended the election. And then the other guy, you know, there was no hiring a Latino mayor after that happened. It was like, we're not fucking with that. We're not fucking with the system. We need to, you know.
And that defined political discourse for another 8 years.
Yes.
and the element of immigrants and terrorism, you know, defines it again now, and it has always, you know, sort of like it trying to find a way forward, that would honor all people, which is also what Hamilton does. So, like, I mean, and I've talked about this a little bit, but it because it's just happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of people in this country, you know, made a decision for whatever reason, you know, some better than others, but they are people. But, you know, the progressive fight of, you know, racial lines and immigration, which is so much of what Hamilton speaks about, what as an artist, you know, how do you impulsively or, you know, now 2-3 days after, what do you feel going forward? What has it been invigorated in you?
Well, you know, there's the initial despair that your candidate didn't win and
right.
the values that you believe in didn't win.
And that's normal.
And then, I don't know, I woke up with an enormous sense of moral clarity, mm-hmm. Which, as you know, for progressives is always hard.
Yeah.
Clarity is never something that's close to in the conversation. It's like, well, what about this? But what about this? But have you considered this perspective?
Right.
You know, we consider so many perspectives that right. sometimes we're paralyzed.
Right.
But in the face of this, it was like, well, this was a campaign. The campaign that won was run on the alienation of others. It was in the first speech, Mexicans are sending over rapists and criminals.
Mm-hmm.
In the next speech, it was, we're going to ban all the Muslims. And so my first thought was, okay, our job is to make the Americans he's alienating feel safe. Like, that's my job through my art, and that's my job through my work. And you know, if Hamilton's anything, it's a reminder that as complicated as those founders were, we live in their country, and great shit has happened in this country too, and it's our country too. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of woke up being like, okay, well, we need to hold the line on the things we believe in and not slide backwards.
Yeah, and not be pushed out.
And not be pushed out, and not be silenced by the things we
that's
believe.
Right.
You know, that's the important thing is, people will protest. People protested Obama forever, and I didn't agree with those protesters, but, you know, let them do it. That's why we get to live here.
Yeah.
And now the pendulum is swung the other way, and we can't shut up, and we got to continue to fight for our values.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This movie, like, I watched a couple of clips of the animated movie.
Yeah, Moana. Oh, what a dream.
It's good, though.
The
small
great.
Clips I saw, it's like, you know, I'm a little closeted musical fan. And
you're out the closet. We heard you sing Herod. Welcome. We welcome you with open arms. You're safe here, Mark.
But like, I don't watch a lot of animated, but I watched two clips of Moana, called, and I was like,
I don't want to put politics on Disney, but I'm just so grateful that there's like it's a movie with like a kick-ass female character saving the world. And she doesn't have a love interest. She doesn't have a boyfriend. She like sails into the sea and saves the fucking world. And I'm really proud to be a part of it and have contributed music to it.
Well, I'm proud of you.
Thanks.
And honor to have you here, and I'm really humbled by the fact that you love the show so much, and that night that you did that on stage was very moving for me.
Thanks for all the interviews, and thanks for getting so much honesty out of so many people we love. You know, I think of so many of your interviews and be like, I never saw that person in that way before.
If
the beginning of art is empathy, is walking, like, you give us a masterclass in it every time you get someone in this crazy garage of yours.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I had to learn that. I was a pretty selfish guy for a long time, but I needed to talk to you today.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm a little shook up.
Yeah, we all are.
Okay. Thanks, man. That's it. What a lovely man. What a great show. Great artist. I was honored to have him over. I believe I will play guitar. I believe I have not planned anything, but that hasn't stopped me before.
Boomer lives.